many friends and colleagues and former students from Montreal were in the audience. So thank you so much for this great honor. Okay, so what I would like to do is to give you a bit of an overview of sort of research endeavor I've been involved in, sort of in collaboration over the past 8 to 9 years with Felix Finster, Joel Smoller, and and the purpose of this collaboration has been to try to, as I will explain, understand in as completely as possible the long time behavior of solutions of various wave equations of physical import in Kerr geometry. Most of what I will talk about today you can find in a paper that's about to appear in the bulletin of the AMS, sort of a survey paper, which contains more details than what I will do in my talk. But at least my talk can give you a general idea of what's going on. And if you're interested, you can have a look at the bulletin paper. So I'm not assuming that this is an audience of relativists. So the first thing I would like to do, so I've put an outline of my talk over here. The first thing I would like to do is to tell you a little bit about the Kerr metric. So for the experts in the audience, I apologize in advance. So what is the Kerr metric? So the Kerr metric is an exact solution, exact closed form analytic solution of the Einstein field equations in vacuum discovered in 1963. In fact, it's a parameterized family of solutions. And I might as well write it down explicitly. So it's given by delta over U. I will tell you what delta and U are in a moment. Dt minus A sine squared theta d phi squared minus U dr squared over delta plus d theta squared minus sine squared theta over u adt minus r squared plus, no minus, I'm right, r squared plus a squared d phi, the whole thing squared. In this expression, delta is a function of r only, which is defined as r squared minus 2mr plus a squared. U is a function of r and theta, which is defined as r squared plus a squared cosine squared of theta. So a and m are real parameters. So m is positive, a can be positive or negative, and I'm working in the range in which a squared is less than m squared. This is the so-called non-extreme Kerr metric. So as I said, this solves the Einstein vacuum equations. So the Ricci tensor of G is equal to zero. What does this metric describe? Well, it describes the outer geometry, or what's called the geometry in the domains of outer communications of a rotating black hole in equilibrium. So M corresponds to the mass of the black hole. A is the angular momentum per unit mass. So these are all quantities defined asymptotically. They're measured from infinity. So why is this? Why does this correspond to a black hole? Well, this metric, if you look at the range of the coordinates, well, in these coordinates are is bounded below by R1, which is the largest of the two roots of this quadratic polynomial. So the metric is not, in this coordinate system, defined at R equals R1, but you can analytically extend it across this hypersurface. And in this analytically extended metric, R equals R1 is the event horizon for this space-time geometry. So this metric describes this space-time, in these coordinates, space-time geometry outside the event horizon, what's called the domain of other communications. So it's the closure of the chronological past of future null infinity intersected with the chronological future of past null infinity. The range of the other coordinates is, of course, t runs from minus to plus infinity, and theta phi describe coordinates on the two-sphere. This outer region, the manifold topology, is R2 cross S2. And the event horizon itself is, as a manifold, diffeomorphic to R cross S2. Now, why is this metric important? Well, this is one of the few really interesting instances in almost any physical theory where there is an exact solution which represents precisely a set of solutions to a very natural boundary value problem for the Einstein equation. So there is the importance of the Kerr metric, it comes from the black hole uniqueness theorem. So this black hole uniqueness theorem says that under asymptotic conditions of weak asymptotic simplicity, under the assumption that the domain of other communications has this topology, there is a non-degenerate event horizon, which has that topology, under some causality assumptions and some symmetry assumptions, which I will make a bit more explicit in a moment, then this boundary value problem for the Einstein equations has a unique parameterized family of solutions consisting in the Kerr family. Okay. So this is physically this represents a exterior geometry of a rotating black hole in equilibrium. So exterior geometry of rotating black hole in equilibrium. Has to be Kerr. This is a meta-theorem. So there is, this theorem is associated to several names, Werner Israel, Brandon Carter, David Robinson. Recently, Piotr Ruchiel has written a very extensive work in which he's gone through he's weakened the hypothesis and cleaned up the proof in his usual very thorough way. But essentially, this is the substance of this theorem. So I think the importance of the Kerr metric cannot be overstated from the perspective of someone interested in mathematical relativity. All right, so what are the symmetry and other geometric properties of this solution? You can see, I'll just erase the top portion of the panel for now. So you see that the metric, the components of the metric are independent of T and phi. So this metric has two commuting Killing vector fields. So geometric properties. So we have d by dt and d by d phi, which are commuting Killing vector fields. In fact, this metric is the Lorentzian analog of, let me say an extra property, and then I'll make that my comment. Not only do we have two commuting killing vector fields, but also the action of this abelian isometry group is orthogonally transitive, meaning that if you take the distribution consisting of the two planes, which are everywhere orthogonal to the orbits of the isometry group, this distribution is integrable. Geometrically, what this means is that if you look at the at this metric, there are no cross terms between the TR and, sorry, T phi and R theta blocks. So you can always, once you choose coordinates adapted to this orthogonal foliation, these cross terms are gone, so you've got an orthogonally transitive action. This metric is a Lorentzian analog of one of the metrics that Festi Apostolov discussed in his, or mentioned in his talk yesterday. It's got many, many beautiful geometric properties beyond these, which we will exploit in a little moment, which are related to the separability of wave equations. And so the separability of these wave equations is related to itself to the integrability of the geodesic flow by quadratic first integrals. All right? Okay. Now, let's focus a little bit on these killing vector fields. There is something about this geometry which is particularly intriguing and which makes life very complicated for anybody who is interested in studying wave equations in this geometry. So let me draw a picture and then explain what this picture is meant to represent. So let's schematically think of this axis as being the axis of rotation. And let's think of this hypersurface as being, as representing the event horizon of my black hole. Well, if you calculate the norm squared of d by dt in the Kerr geometry, so this is gtt, what you obtain, just going back to this formula here and collecting terms, is 1 over u r squared minus 2mr plus a squared cosine squared theta. And don't forget, this hypersurface, the event horizon, is r equals, is the region in which r squared minus 2mr plus a squared is, this region inside, is the region in which, so this is zero on the event horizon, it changes sign inside. But what you see is that even before you reach the event horizon, there is a region with compact closure where the generator of this killing vector field d by dt, which is the generator of time translations, becomes space-like. So here d by dt is space-like. Outside this region, d by dt is time-like. So this metric isn't quite stationary. It's only stationary at sufficiently large distances. This region in which d by dt becomes space-like with compact closure is called the ergosphere. It makes life very complicated because any time you're going to use invariance of the space-time geometry on the time translations to construct a conserved energy for a wave equation, this conserved energy can be negative inside this region. So solving the Cauchy problem, analyzing decay using Hilbert space methods won't work. This is the the main difficulty. So there is lack of positivity of the energy. On the other hand, this also allows for very interesting applications. If time allows, I will tell you a little bit about the Penrose process and superradiance. These are very interesting geometric and analytic processes that take place in the Kerr geometry, and this can happen precisely because of the presence of this region. Of course, in the limit in which A, so you remember A is the angular momentum per unit mass, in the limit in which A tends to zero, so maybe I'll state this as a remark, so for A equals zero, Kerr reduces to the well-known Schwarzschild metric, which is spherically symmetric, and the ergosphere is empty. So this region here shrinks. As A tends to zero, this region here shrinks, and in the limit, it becomes empty. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why analyzing wave equations in Schwarzschild is much more, well, it's less problematic than analyzing wave equations in the Kerr geometry. Okay, so let's see if there is anything else that I wanted to say for now about the Kerr metric. Well, I think that's more or less it for now about Kerr. So let me state what is the general question that I'm interested in. So the general question is the following. So suppose we're given a wave equation. And I'm using a generic term for wave equation. I will tell you, so I'll write this generically as Tg of psi is equal to zero, g referring to the Kerr metric. Well, what is Tg? Well, in the applications that I will mention today, I will just deal with the case in which Tg is either the Dirac operator or the scalar wave D'Alembertian. But in general, you could take Tg, so I should say where Tg equals, could be the Dirac operator, could be the scalar wave D'Alembertian, it could be the operator for Maxwell's equations. Put an M for Maxwell. It could be the linearized Einstein equations. And there are more possibilities. We could also look at nonlinear wave equations in this geometry. What's the general question? Well, the general question is to understand the dynamics. Maybe I can write this here. We want to understand the dynamics of the solutions as t tends to infinity, where by dynamics I mean lots of things. I mean decay properties, including perhaps whenever possible decay rates. As you'll see, it's a hard problem to get decay rates. It's understanding scattering. This is sort of tied to this Penrose process and superradiance. And it can also mean many, many other things. But for, I think, the most important questions, and which are already quite difficult as stated, are just understanding decay rates and decay properties, decay rates, and scattering. And to attack this type of problem, there are two schools, and I think it's fair to say that they're competing schools, that have been working on this type of question for the past, whatever, 7, 8, 9 years. So the two general approaches are the following. And I think, as I will try to explain, each of these approaches has its strengths and it also has its limitations. And as you'll see in a moment. Okay. So there is an approach based on spectral methods and Fourier analysis. So this is exploits in a critical way the fine structure of the Kerr geometry. I haven't made this explicit yet. I'll make it explicit in a moment. But it turns out that in Kerr geometry, not only is the geodesic flow completely integrable by means of quadratic first integrals, but also the Dirac operator, the scalar wave operator, Maxwell's equations, the linearized Einstein equations, the Rarita-Schwinger equation, any equation you're interested in, happens to be to decompose in a geometrically very beautiful way into a sum of operators involving one variable only. So this exploits, in a critical way, separation of variables. So the idea there is to separate, it's what physicists do, also what mathematicians do. You separate variables, you obtain solutions corresponding to individual modes, and then you write the solution of the Cauchy problem as a Fourier integral slash series, giving a superposition of these elementary modes. I'll show this to you in a moment for Dirac and the scalar wave equation. So this was started by the physicists many years ago. I mean, the rigorous results that I'm aware of in this line of work. So I should mention the names of the physicists. I mean, they're very famous people. They're, you know, Chandrasekhar, Nobel laureate, Zeldovich, Starobinsky, Friedman. I mean, some very, very, very good people have worked on this. And most of their results deal with individual modes, and the culmination of this work for individual modes is a theorem of Bernard Whiting that I will tell you about in a few minutes. This is a theorem which says that in Kerr geometry, if you look at individual modes arising from separation of variables for any of these equations here, there are no modes that grow exponentially in time. Okay? So it's a theorem about the absence of poles of the resolvent of these operators in the upper half plane. So this is for modes. In the general case, so rigorous results for general Cauchy data, or fairly general Cauchy data, but using the same philosophy is the work my collaborators and I have been involved in. The limitation of this work is that you need to make assumptions about the support of the data. And in some cases, symmetry of data. So limitations, strength. These results work for values of this angular momentum parameter all the way up to the full range between of A getting arbitrarily close to n squared is allowed. So is allowed. So these results are not restricted to small perturbations of spherically symmetric Schwarzschild geometry. These are results which really hold all the way in the entire range of this, in the entire range of parameters. The other method, which is more in the spirit of hyperbolic PDEs, is the methods or the so-called multiplier or vector field methods. So these also exploit symmetries, but they exploit symmetries in an approximate sense. So whereas we deal with killing vectors and killing tensors in the exact sense, multiplier methods use vector fields which are almost killing vectors. So they're killing vectors up to a small error term to get decay results. I will quote one of the results for you in a little while. The names associated to this are Kleinerman, Rodniansky, Michalis Tafermos, Avi Zoffer, Peter Blue, who was a student of Zoffer, and others. Okay. So, what's the limitation? Oh, I should also add some very interesting recent work of Tataru, who actually has really done something very good. I'll tell you about this in a moment. The limitations are that this only works for a squared very small relative to n squared. So this is small perturbations of Schwarzschild. On the other hand, the strength, in my opinion, the main strength, is that general data are allowed. In the works of Tafermos, Rodniansky, and company, the data are allowed to have support all the way up to the event horizon. Tataru has, by a very, very brilliant insight, shown how to get results for data which are supported across the event horizon. But the main limitation is that this is essentially spherical symmetry in disguise. So this spherical symmetry with a bit of a stomach. Okay. Yes. Yes, yes, exactly. Well, if you prolong the if you do this analytic continuation trick, you can write an expression for the operator which is smooth, which has smooth coefficients across the event horizon. You do your analysis in that coordinate system, and then you go back to the original coordinate system. Oh, the ergosphere is no problem. I mean, the type of the metric, the signature of the metric doesn't change as you cross the ergosphere. I should have pointed this out. Thank you, Marco. So the metric still has Lorentzian signature inside the ergosphere all the way up to the event horizon. So the space, the hypersurfaces T equals constant are space-like. The reason is that this vector field d by dt is not orthogonal to one, to hypersurfaces, it twists. So that's not a problem. All right, so enough generalities. Let me tell you a little bit about some results. I'll try to give you as much as possible of the but thanks, Marco. It was a very timely and good question. Okay. running. All right. So some results. Let me start with the Dirac operator. So that's point two. We talk about decay for Dirac. Oh my goodness, sorry, I should have said in my little panorama, I should have had a little subsection on spectral methods. So for Dirac, there are also methods that come strictly from scattering theory that work extremely well for the Dirac operator. For the aficionados in the audience, there is also everything that's based on the so-called Moule estimate. So the Moule estimate is an estimate that's used in scattering theory to prove asymptotic completeness for, typically it's for Schrödinger operators, also works for Dirac operators. The Moore estimate also gives you decay results, but in a weaker sense. Okay? And this is mostly the French school associated to people like Bachelot, Alain Bachelot, Dietrich Heffner, Thierry Daudet, Jean-Philippe Nicolas. But there are also very, very good results. Okay, so decay for Dirac. So Dirac is the easy case. Let me tell you why Dirac is the easy case. Because if you take the Dirac equation in Kerr geometry, so I'll draw this picture again. In some sense, the Dirac operator doesn't see the ergosphere as far as getting a conserved energy is concerned. So you can always take the Dirac operator and rewrite it somewhere, but you can rewrite it in Hamiltonian form in terms of a unitary evolution for a Hamiltonian operator H, and you can write down a conserved scalar product on spinner fields defined on hypersurfaces T equals constant. So you write the scalar product, which is conserved, it's got zero time derivative for any psi 1, psi 2, which solve the Dirac equation. And this scalar, and H, is self-adjoint, or essentially self-adjoint, with respect to this scalar product that I've written here. This scalar product is essentially a twist that depends on the parameter A, so I should really put an index here. I mean, the choice of scalar product depends on the extent to which this geometry fails to be spherically symmetric. So it's a twist of the standard conserved scalar product associated to the conserved current for the Dirac operator. So there is a conserved current for the Dirac operator. So this divergence-free vector field, you take this, you massage it a bit, you get something which works for the Hamiltonian form. And then you can solve abstractly the Cauchy problem, so you can set up a Hilbert space structure on the space of initial data, and then by standard theorems, you can solve the Dirac equation in terms of initial data psi zero. So let me write a precise theorem about this. So I said the spectral method uses separation of variables. So this was a magnificent discovery made by Brandon Carter for the wave equation and Chandrasekhar for the Dirac operator. So to evaluate this one parameter family of unitary transformations, because we need to write this down explicitly to do analysis, we use separation of variables for Dirac. And separation of variables is going to enable you to rewrite an operator which is. So this, my Dirac operator always has a mass term in it. I should say, so dg is the Dirac operator with master. And I'm taking the mass to be non-zero. Okay? So you write this with a suitable choice of, so this you can think of as a change of spinner frame given by pre-multiplication by S inverse, and U is a non-singular multiplication operator, and this operator splits into the sum of a radial and an angular operator. It's miraculous, but it happens to be, the case. I mean, there is good geometric reasons why this is going on, but I can't get into this now. So this is separation of the Dirac operator into radial and angular part. It's true you only have two commuting Killing vectors, but there are additional symmetries of the Dirac operator that make this possible, related to the presence of Killing tensor, in fact, in this case, of a rank two Killing spinner. Ties in with what Vesti was talking about yesterday. All right, so you do this. At the level of individual modes, you separate variables. This is for individual modes. Sorry, this is a spinner, so I need to write k plus 1/2 phi minus I omega t. And then you have some spinner that depends only on r and theta. There is a certain ansatz that works that enables you to rewrite your original Dirac equation into a system, coupled system of ordinary first order matrix equations. So let me write it like this. So here, at this level, I'll fix k and omega are fixed. So these operators are going to depend on k and omega. And a bit of elliptic perturbation theory. So this A operator is a perturbation of the Dirac operator on the two-sphere. A bit of elliptic perturbation theory shows that A has a discrete spectrum, non-degenerate, when A is non-zero, with eigenvalues, of course, depending on omega and k. In the spherically symmetric case, the eigenvalues don't depend on omega and k. You get the standard spectrum of the Laplacian on the two-sphere. In this case, this deformation, which sort of arises from the purely axisymmetric of character of the metric, causes these eigenvalues to depend on omega and k. So you can see where the problem is going to be when you want to write down the solution of the Cauchy problem for the Dirac equation in terms of a convergent Fourier integral representation. You need to have estimates on the behavior of the spectrum which are uniform in omega and k. Otherwise, you're still at the level of individual. Fortunately, this works. And they're ODE estimates. I mean, they're not, doesn't mean they're easy, but they're very explicit ODE estimates. And so at the end, what you get is a representation for the solution of the Dirac equation as a sum over k in z, e to the minus I k plus 1/2 phi, a sum over n in n. So this n label corresponds to the labels of these points in the discrete, purely discrete spectrum of A. And what you get is an integral. So it's integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, e to the minus I omega t. It's a bit heavy notation. I apologize for that. Sorry. I'll just write this complicated equation one. There is a similar equation for the wave equation, but I promise you I won't write it. okay, I should put k omega n here, k omega n there. So what does this mean? It means that we're writing the psi zero are the Cauchy data. So where psi zero are Cauchy data, and the assumption on the Cauchy data is that they're in L2 of R1 plus infinity cross S2 to the fourth, right? Because a spinner has four components. And I want them to be bounded near the event horizon. So under these assumptions, this is a convergent representation for the solution to the Cauchy problem. These psi A's and psi B's, these correspond to fundamental solutions of the radial equation that behave as outgoing geodesic spherical waves at the event horizon, incoming geodesic spherical waves from infinity. So these are solutions which have well-defined asymptotics at infinity and at the event horizon. These come from analyzing the radial equations. And these quantities here you can think of as transmission coefficients. These are, you can write down formulas for them. And proving anything about this type of solution, not only convergence, but also decay, is going to involve getting understanding the behavior of these transmission coefficients in terms of k omega. So this is a convergent representation for the solution. So we can use this. So where does this come from, I should say? So this comes from writing this expression as using the functional calculus as e to the minus I omega t d of e omega acting on psi zero. And to evaluate the spectral measure, what you do is what Hermann Weyl taught us to do. You put the problem in a radial box in an annular region with Dirichlet boundary conditions on the wall of the box. So this is going to be, in that case, the spectrum is going to be purely discrete. And then you need to take limits as one of the walls of the box goes to the event horizon, the other one goes to infinity. And these partials and these sums, these whatever, this infinite sum, this Tilchus type integral converges. I mean, the measure converges to the spectral measure associated to the operator. And these things here come from evaluating the spectral measure in the limit. That's how we get the formulas for that. So what do we do with this? Let me state one, in fact, a couple of decay theorems. So theorem one, so under the same assumptions on my initial data, what you can show is that for any delta positive r greater than r1, the limit as t tends to infinity of the integral over a certain compact set, k delta r, which I will define for you in a moment, of psi bar gamma j psi mu j d mu tends to zero. So what does that, what is k delta r? So it's the set of points t r theta phi such that r lies between r1 plus delta and let's put a delta here and capital R. So intuitively you think of this being the hypersurface T equals constant, and you have a compact spatial region K delta R, which is this, which is a, like a compact annular region in this space-like hypersurface. And this theorem says that the limit as T tends to infinity of the integral of the normal component of the Dirac current on this compact region tends to zero. So intuitively what this says is that the wave or this Dirac spinner cannot stay localized in any spatial region for arbitrarily large values of time. So either things all go to infinity or cross the event horizon and get absorbed by the black hole. This is in contrast with what happens for the behavior of classical particles of geodesics. I mean, you know that the Kerr metric has trapped geodesics, but at the level of the Dirac operator, this doesn't count. How do you prove this? Well, you go to this expression here, and you need to estimate these Fourier coefficients. So the Fourier coefficients are in here, and the key estimate that you need is to show that the Fourier coefficients are in L1 of omega, with respect to omega. And then the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma tells you that the Fourier transform tends to zero as t tends to infinity. Okay? So you need L1 estimates in omega. I mean, that's the hardest to get this thing here to work. Okay? Rates of decay, that's theorem 2. Let me just leave this representation here. I'll just erase down there. So for rates, getting sharp rates by the spectral methods can be done, but you need to. But I don't have any rates which are uniform in K and M. So the rate I'm going to quote for you works for finitely many Ks, for a superposition involving finitely many Ks and finitely many Ns. So we assume that K in absolute value is between 0 and K0, N in absolute value is between 0 and N0, but there is no restriction on omega. So the in terms of the energy, you take a superposition of waves having energy supported all the way from minus to plus infinity, but this basically means that you're looking at waves whose projected angular momentum on the axis of symmetry is given, or a finite superposition of waves with given projected angular momentum. And this is sort of like fixing, in some sense, a generalized total angular momentum, although we don't really know what physically this represents. It comes out of the analysis, but physically or even geometrically, this is not so clear for me. And then the theorem says that under these assumptions, psi of xt, the leading order behavior is in t to the minus 5/6, plus an error term. So if I really want to be pedantic about it, you can even estimate this epsilon. Oh, let's see. Doesn't matter. I mean, epsilon is less than 130. It's not so important. Point is that the leading order behavior is t to the minus 5/6. This is sharp. So when we got this result, we were very, very surprised. I didn't believe in it. And here is the reason. So if you're in flat space, if you're in Minkowski space, you know that the rate of decay is, so for Minkowski, the rate of decay is in t to the minus 3/2. This metric is asymptotically flat. Near the event horizon, this Dirac particle behaves essentially as a massless particle. So the rate of decay has to be rapid. You need to have rapid decay at the event horizon. So intuitively, you would say, okay, well, if you're In a metric which is asymptotically flat and things decay rapidly at the event horizon, the sharp rate of decay should interpolate somewhere between minus 3/2 and rapid decay. Turns out to be false. Slower. So it's slower in here. The mathematical reason for this has to do with Fourier analysis. So let me explain this to you, because I think it's you'll see why this is happening from a mathematical point of view, at least. So you know, if you're in Minkowski space, the energy spectrum of the initial data has a gap, so it can't be supported between minus m and plus m. Support has to be either here or there. Okay? In Kerr geometry, the initial data, in general, can have energy spectrum supported across what was the forbidden interval. But what happens, and this comes in from the estimates that we derive to get convergence, what happens is that this Fourier transform oscillates a lot as omega approaches m. In fact, the rate is as sine of 1 over square root of m minus omega. Omega minus m, if I approach from this side. So when you calculate the Fourier integral, when you estimate the Fourier integral, you need to add up these additional oscillations. And it's adding up these additional oscillations that causes the Fourier integral to decay more slowly in time as t tends to infinity. This is what's going on mathematically. Physically, well, you know, it's the wave functions like to spread out. Gravity is trying to slow this down. Well, eventually, of course, they win because the exponent is negative. But there is a price to be paid. That's where it's coming from. I'm almost out of time. I definitely won't get to the Penrose process. Let me just take 3 minutes to, I mean, this was the easy part of the problem, because everything was taking place in a Hilbert space setting. I'll tell you a little bit about the decay for the scalar wave D'Alembertian. This is much, much harder to do. I mean, the Dirac thing we got done in a couple of years of work, this took a lot longer. Why? Because the scalar wave operator definitely sees the ergosphere. There is no way of escaping that. If you write down the conserved energy for energy density for the scalar wave equation, it's a quadratic form in the first derivatives of phi. The coefficient of the phi derivative is 1 over sine squared theta minus a squared over delta, norm of the phi derivative of phi squared. This term here is negative inside the ergosphere. So the nice thing that happened with the Dirac operator, where you could write down this conserved energy, which was positive definite, all the way to the ergosphere, doesn't take place for the wave equation. So there is no way of escaping this. So there is a similar Fourier series / integral representation for the solutions to the Cauchy problem. It's miraculous that you can actually write down an expression that's supported on the real line. Let me explain how this comes about. So the way we do it is, again, a la Hermann Weyl. So we set the problem in a box, a rectangular box. And when you set up the problem in a rectangular box, you can, again, write down the equation in Hamiltonian form as a first-order system. And with Dirichlet boundary conditions on the walls of the box, H is a self-adjoint operator on what's called the Pontryagin space, for a Krein space. So this is a space which is a function space which is endowed with an inner product of split signature, and there is the negative definite subspace in the Pontryagin space case is finite dimensional. So when you do, there is a spectral theorem that works in this context too. You get spectral points on the real axis. Sorry, so now I'm in the omega plane, and then you get, because of the presence of this, the dimension is finite, of this negative space, and you get finitely many pairs of complex spectral points. What happens is that as the walls of the box go to infinity and to the event horizon, the number of these points grows. But the estimates show that as their numbers grow, they get closer and closer to the real axis, which is something which is quite amazing. And at the end, so you can reduce things to a contour which is contained within a little epsilon neighborhood of the real axis. And then this result of Whiting that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk about the non-existence of exponentially unstable modes, plus a lot of work, enables you to deform, to shrink the contour all the way to the real axis. Once you're done, you have a similar type of representation. And again, additional estimates enable you to apply Riemann-Lebesgue and prove decay. But we have no results about rates in this case. I expect the rate to be the same, but we don't know how to prove it. So in the 3 minutes that remain, so I won't tell you about the Penrose process. So I did this, I won't tell you about the Penrose process. Let me tell you a little bit about what I think are interesting open problems and perspectives. One interesting and doable open problem is to understand what goes on in the extreme Kerr case. So this is the case in which a squared equals m squared. So perspectives, and there are many things one can write. But one of the interesting ones is to understand what goes in the case a squared equals m squared. This is the so-called extreme Kerr case. That's the case in which the two roots of this quadratic polynomial coalesce. So what's very interesting here is that the Dirac operator has bound states, non-trivial bound states. That's a result of a student of Felix Finster who proved this. So the situation, dynamically is quite different. And it would be very, very interesting to understand what goes on with how decay and decay rates fit to this picture when you have solutions which are L2. From my perspective, and this is what I'm working on right now, I think the case of higher dimensional black holes, and in particular this Myers-Perry solutions, is extremely interesting from a mathematical point of view, because there I think all bets are open. So there's no reason to believe that this type of result will hold. But nevertheless, you can separate variables for the Dirac equation. So there is hope to be able to at least get started in a similar way. So there exists separation of variables. Very, very interesting. I should say in dimension 5. I don't know if this can be done in higher dimensions or not. And it's anything but trivial. in this Myers-Perry geometry, you have two angular momentum parameters instead of one to work with. And the horizon structure is a lot more complicated. It's very, very interesting. So this is being investigated right now. One way or another, either by multiplier methods, a la Kleinerman, Rutniansky, Lefermos, Blue, Zoffer, and company, Tataru, or by spectral methods, although I'm doubtful that this can be done by spectral methods, we need to get more general decay theorems, so decay theorems for general Cauchy data. It's a technical problem, but it's more than technical. It has to do with the philosophy with which you approach these questions. Our approach was to make sort of maximal use of the specific structure of Kerr. Maybe you need to move back and look at Kerr as a member of a much more general class of metrics and see what goes on. In some sense, I think this problem is easier when you, instead of having an asymptotically flat metric, you have a metric which is asymptotically the sitter or anti the sitter. Analytically, it's easier. Now, the million-dollar problem. It's to do nonlinear stability for even Schwarzschild. I mean, this is, Christodoulou and Kleinerman proved nonlinear stability for Minkowski space with very important improvements made afterwards by a number of people. This is the test case in some sense. So understanding even linear stability for more general higher spin operators is still largely an open question. This will be the test case for doing the full nonlinear stability. I wouldn't make any bets on what could happen because there are some really very, very good people thinking about this, and I, including Christodoulou in particular. So we'll see. Anyway, I think I've taken enough of your time. Thank you. It's non-zero. That's all we know. But it's. No. It depends. I mean, shouldn't think of your intuition of bound states. These are not bound states. These are like waves. So near the event horizon, it looks like a spherical wave, a superposition of something that goes in and something that comes out. So it doesn't decay. In fact, these theorems, say that there are no bound states in the range a squared less than b squared. So these really look like spherical geodesic waves in this range. But for that value, then if you could get a similar type of result, then C of X would, of course, have to decay at the event horizon. But we know the asymptotics of the solutions at the event horizon in our case. They're like spherical waves. Yes. That's right, absolutely. That's right. It has a Killingiano tensor. Yes. Exactly. That's right. That's right. So this is exactly what I'm working on right now. You're absolutely right. So the formal geometric properties are very similar But you need to be extremely careful about the range of parameters in which you work, precisely because of the existence of these black rings. But give me a few months, and I'll have the answer for you.